Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did it come about?
Let's have a bit of history.
It is not black and white, is it?
That raises big questions.
There are repercussions around the world.
It's a hugely complicated picture.
The official narrative is somewhat different.
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 23rd of May, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister calls a general election on the 4th of July. Reaction from Palestinians and Israelis to the decision of Spain, Ireland and Norway to recognise Palestine as a state. Also in this podcast,
we basically produce super saturated hot humid air. When you condense water contained in that air, you would have the drinking water at your disposal.
A new device that could prove life-saving during droughts or emergencies. And Colombia buries Omar Helles, one of its most influential folk singers. The British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has announced a general election on the 4th of July. It was something no one was predicting this time yesterday, as the opposition Labour Party has a commanding lead over the governing Conservatives in opinion polls. Speaking in Downing Street in the pouring rain, Rishi Sunak made his pitch to voters, saying this was the moment for Britain to choose its future, promising a clear plan and bold action.
Now is the moment for Britain to choose its future. To decide whether we want to build on the progress we have made or risk going back to square one with no plan and no certainty. Earlier today, I spoke with His Majesty the King to request the dissolution of Parliament. The King has granted this request, and we will have a general election on the 4th of July. These uncertain times call for a clear plan and bold action to chart a course to a secure future.
In Britain, the timing of elections is in the gift of the Prime Minister, so why call one now? I've been talking to our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
Why is he doing it? Well, the speculation is that he's made the calculation that this is probably as good as it's going to get for the governing Conservative Party, that although they are a long way behind in the opinion polls, really spectacularly way behind and unpopular, there has been somewhat better news on inflation, somewhat better news on economic growth, and I suspect Mr. Sunak fears that if you think about the main problem that the Conservatives are up against, that is political gravity, having been in power for 14 years and no certainty that actually economic progress will continue, you might as well cut your losses and go for an election now. But this has been a consistently something like a 21% lead for the main opposition Labour Party, not for a few weeks, not for a few months, but for over a year. And I think, again, it goes back to that issue of political gravity and, of course, their record in office.
Now, Rishi Sunak's pitch to voters is about the economy. It is the day when inflation fell, perhaps more than people were expecting. It's a message of we're on the right track. Better the devil you know.
Yes, I'm glad you laid it out that way. They all say, the Americans say, there's only three kinds of elections, basically. We're on the right track, number one, better the devil you know, or time for a change. And the Conservatives are going for a sort of mix of one and two. And Rishi Sunak was essentially saying, goodness, look at the world out there, the war in Ukraine, the uncertainty in the Middle East. This isn't really a time for change to an unknown opposition, to an uncharted opposition. Whereas, of course, what we've had from the main opposition Labour Party so far, and its leader Keir Starmer, is exactly that word, change. It is time for a change, he argues, the party argues, after 14 years of what he calls chaos.
Let's hear what Keir Starmer had to say an hour ago.
On the 4th of July, you have the choice. And together, we can stop the chaos, we can turn the page, we can start to rebuild Britain and change our country. Time and again, they pursue their own interests rather than tackling the issues that affect your family. And if they get another 5 years, they will feel entitled to carry on exactly as they are. Nothing will change.
We're going to hear Sir Keir Starmer playing that potent political card of change all the time, I should think. In terms of what the issues will be in the coming weeks in the election campaign, Rob, obviously the economy, that's always there. Migration, the NHS.
I mean, I think in a way it'll be like a giant hole, won't it? It'll be a mix of all of those things that the Labour Party will be saying, look, you know, do you, after 14 years of Conservative government, do you feel better off? Do you feel like public services are working well? Do you feel like the zeitgeist of the country and its place in the whole world is a good thing? And, you know, obviously expecting the voters to say no. And the polling suggests that the voters do feel very negatively about those things. Whereas, you know, the Conservatives will be saying repeatedly, look, we may not be perfect, but you know us. We've had some slightly better figures. And the opposition, they don't really have a plan. You know, in many ways, Andrew, we already know, although it's only the election is only a couple of hours old, we know exactly what the sort of nature of the contest will be in that sense.
When we get to polling day on July the 4th, Rishi Sunak will have been Prime Minister for less than 2 years. Who knows whether he gets the chance to continue or not. But in terms of his legacy so far, he was Finance Minister during COVID. He's claimed to have stabilised the economy as Prime Minister. Probably the biggest thing he'll end up being remembered for is banning smoking.
It's interesting you should raise that, and I don't think he would particularly mind that. I mean, clearly he would like to win the general election, and he will make the case over the next few weeks as to why that should be. But he obviously feels very passionately about this. I say that because, you know, there's a large chunk of the governing Conservative Party that hates this idea of sort of nanny statism. So you're absolutely right. I mean, if he does lose this election, maybe the sort of economic policies will be long forgotten. Most of what he do will be forgotten, but not perhaps taking the most radical approach to eliminating smoking of any Western country.
And just finally, it's been a fever day at Westminster. Rob, do you feel ready for weeks of this, conversation, TV debates, all that stuff?
I did want to raise a couple of points. And number one is that this, you know, this election is going to be taking against a pretty sour backdrop. The opinion polling and focus groups, it's really shocking, Andrew, the extent to which, you know, the voters just don't like any of the politicians or the political parties. I mean, it is really striking. The other thing that I would say is that this election is taking place against a sour mood in the sense that this feels like a country that senses that it's on the wrong track and that life is getting worse. So it's going to be a big battle for the politicians.
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson. In our earlier podcast, we reported on the news that Ireland, Norway and Spain are to recognise Palestine as an independent state. Let's get some reaction now from Israel and the Palestinians. First, our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, on the significance of this decision.
Most countries in the world already think the Palestinians have a state. 143 nations voted to that effect at the United Nations earlier this month. So adding another three to the list might not seem that important. But the decision by Norway, Spain and the Republic of Ireland to recognise Palestinian statehood is unusual and significant. Only 9 European countries have already made that decision, and most did so in 1988. Norway's Prime Minister, Jonas Gahr Støre, said peace in the Middle East required a Palestinian state. Spain's Premier, Pedro Sanchez, said he hoped it would help secure a ceasefire. Ireland's Taoiseach, Simon Harris, said the Palestinians had a legitimate right to statehood. The Irish, Spanish and Norwegian decision will put some pressure on other European countries to follow suit, but many, including the United States, believe this is too early, that recognising a Palestinian state should come later to drive momentum towards a long-term political settlement. There are also many unanswered questions about where the borders and capital of any Palestinian state may lie. So the diplomatic dial shifted with some symbolic declarations, but the reality on the ground is unlikely to change.
The presidency of the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah has welcomed the move and called on others to follow suit. Amar Hijazi, the Assistant Minister of Multilateral Affairs in Ramallah, described it as crucial for peace.
In our opinion, this step comes at a critical hour when Israel and the occupation is trying to derail this conflict and destroy the chances to achieve peace between peoples. These countries stood up to say that the only path to peace and the only path to justice and security in this region is by granting the Palestinian people their independence, their rights, and in particular, the right to self-determination.
Hamas also welcomed the decision. And here are some views from people in Gaza.
We hope this decision will be implemented and that a Palestinian state will be established along the 1967 borders on the basis of the two-state solution as the international community, European and Arab states demand. We are peace and life-loving people and want to coexist with everyone from every persuasion and religion.
I hope that it will happen, but it's difficult to achieve peace with Israel without guarantees from superpowers such as the US or France.
It's a good step, but it's unfortunately a belated one. After more than 70 years of occupation, they finally recognized the state of Palestine.
But Israelis have reacted with anger. Speaking in Paris, the Foreign Minister Israel Katz said they'd do everything they could to block the move. And Tal Heinrich, spokesperson for the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said it would send the wrong message to the world.
We said many weeks ago and months ago, James, that a recognition of a Palestinian state would be an unprecedented, enormous prize for terrorism that would achieve exactly the opposite of peace. And unfortunately, Spain, Norway, Ireland, as you noted, have joined this list of countries that you mentioned, and they're playing right into Hamas's hands. They are incentivizing their sick methods of war, their sick, monstrous regime, and undermining efforts to release our hostages, our stolen people. You know, appeasing terrorists never panned out well throughout history. This is a reward for the ones who planned and executed the October 7th massacre. It's a prize for the rapists, the murderers, the ones who are still holding our stolen people in captivity.
How is it a reward for Hamas? I mean, they're not going to be in charge in Gaza after the war, are they?
What are the real impediments to peace? Palestinians don't want a state next to Israel. They want the state instead of Israel. This is why they chant from the river to the sea.
Norway explicitly said today that their move was designed to encourage those moderate forces who've been sidelined by groups like Hamas.
But this is not what it's doing. It encourages, it perpetuates war, more conflict and more bloodshed, not less.
Tal Heinrich with James Menendez. This was the reaction in Jerusalem.
The countries that want to recognise a Palestinian state are probably starting from the assumption that the Palestinians want to establish a state according to the principle of two states for two peoples. But this assumption is incorrect, because if the Palestinians wanted to establish a Palestinian state alongside Israel, they could have done it a long time ago.
I feel that the timing now to recognise a Palestinian state during a war and after the events of October 7th shows who these countries are with and what their opinion is about everything that happened here on October the 7th. And to see that the world actually takes the side of Hamas and says, I will give you a state as a reward, that is painful, and I wish things could be seen differently.
Some views from Jerusalem. A device that absorbs water from air to produce drinking water has been officially launched in Australia. Researchers say the so-called hydro harvester could be life-saving during droughts or emergencies. Its developers say it's cheap to run and uses either solar energy or waste heat from industrial processes or machines. From Sydney, here's Phil Mercer.
Drought is like a creeping cancer, according to engineers at the University of Newcastle in New South Wales. Their hydro harvester absorbs moisture from the air and can produce up to 1,000 litres of drinkable water each day. Unlike other commercially available atmospheric water generators, the Australian team led by Professor Behdad Mogdatiri says the invention works by heating air instead of cooling it.
Hydro harvester uses an absorbing material to absorb and dissolve moisture from air. So essentially we use renewable energy, let's say for instance solar energy or waste heat. We basically produce super saturated hot humid air out of the system. When you condense water contained in that air, you would have the drinking water at your disposal.
The researchers say the device can produce enough drinking water each day for up to 400 people. It could also help farmers keep livestock alive during droughts and can function when humidity levels are low.
Given that it can work, unlike other atmospheric water extractors, which are usually work best around a relative humidity of 50 or 60%. Our system can go down all the way to, you know, 10, even 5% if we want to. And for that reason, yes, even in arid, dry climates like Australia, Middle East, it would work perfectly all right.
The hydro harvester will be tested in several remote Australian communities later this year.
Next to Colombia. Omar Helles, one of the greatest folk musicians in Colombia, has died. The vallenato musician was 57, but had a career lasting four decades. My colleague Clitzia Sala told me more about him.
He rose to fame in the 80s. He was part of this group called Los Diablitos, meaning the Little Devils. And throughout his career, he wrote over 800 songs. And I think his most important contribution to the genre was mixing vallenato with rock, bringing it to the younger generations.
So vallenato is very traditional and he was giving it a more contemporary twist.
So vallenato is very traditional music style which hails from Valledupar, which is actually where Helles spent most of his life. And in 2015, the genre was inscribed on the list of UNESCO's intangible cultural heritage. So traditionally, it is played with a small drum and a wooden ribbed stick and an accordion. And Mr. Helles created one of the genre's most iconic songs called Los Caminos de la Vida, meaning the journey of life or the paths of life.
Y los caminos de la vida no son como yo pensaba, como los imaginaba, no son como yo creía.
The lyrics tell the story of a single mother struggling to raise her family, and it's sort of become an anthem for several generations and a tribute to the strength and love of mothers.
Yo pensaba que la vida era distinta cuando estaba pequeñito. Yo creía que las cosas eran fáciles.
And just give us a sense of what influence he had beyond Colombia, because it wasn't restricted to vallenato music in Colombia.
Well, actually, yes. Of course, in the US, there is a great flow of migrants from Colombia and second-generation Colombians. He has a huge following there, but also in other countries in South America.
And in terms of people's affection for him, there's going to be a huge sculpture of him as part of the funeral procession?
Yes, there's a life-size sculpture of him which is going to accompany the funeral procession. And actually, as a tribute to his life and his work, the statue will then be installed in the Cultural Center for Vallenato Music in Valledupar, which is actually considered the capital of Vallenato.
By an art and musician, Omar Helles, who's died. And still to come, a rare standing ovation for a member of the British Parliament, and also a mammoth discovery in an Australian wine cellar. South Africa's former president Jacob Zuma has said he wants to change the country's constitution after being barred from running for parliament in next week's elections. In his first interview since the ruling, Mr. Zuma told my colleague Anne Soy that the country's constitutional court was wrong to decide he was ineligible to run based on his 2021 conviction for contempt of court.
I appeared before the commission of a judge who is in charge of the judges of the constitutional court. And I said it to him, he is a man I know. He can deal with my issues. I need somebody else to do so. I did not refuse to address the issues. They say I'm guilty. They've not even talked to me, and they sent me to prison for 15 months, which I served. You can't tell me there's democracy in this country.
Well, some of the observers internationally, though, thought that perhaps you did not want to answer these questions about corruption.
That is their own business. That's not my business.
For the time you were president.
What I'm telling you now, must tell you, I fought for freedom, my dear. And I cannot look at myself, my right that I fought for, I stayed in prison for, being messed up by a person because he's a judge. Where is fairness?
Well, apart from you being sent to prison for contempt of court, your own former party, should I say, prematurely ended your presidency on corruption allegations. You have
not addressed
that.
No, it was not on corruption allegations. Please, we are making a big mistake. There was no corruption that was ever found on me. Singing about Zuma's corruption was a lot, but who has produced anything? Do you have any evidence?
Some called it state capture.
No.
And some of the people who are alleged to have worked with you left this country.
I don't know what is a state capture means. That even that one, I can tell you a lot. It was all funny. I'm asking if you heard people saying, I am corrupt, what did I do? Do you have any little fact about it?
There's still cases. And next year you'll be appearing before court again.
Am I guilty?
Well, I am not a judge, but...
Precisely. Because we are insisting on a point...
The court has said that you will appear again next year.
Wait, you want to hear me? I don't want to hear you all the time. I'm saying to you, I was removed before I finished my term, and nothing was ever produced as evidence that this was the reason.
And as we go to another election, can South Africans trust you, and what are you going to do differently?
South Africa, trust me. Don't ask whether they can. They are trusting me. They trusted me when I was the president, and you can ask any South African how the country was at the time. They are trusting me now. They are taking me back where they say that's where this is a man we trust.
The former president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, with my colleague Anne Soy. Mexico is coming to the end of the most violent election campaign in the country's modern history. Candidates and politicians have been murdered and threatened as powerful drugs cartels put their stamp on the election. As we heard on yesterday's podcast, 12 bodies were discovered in the coastal city of Acapulco, from where our correspondent Will Grant reports.
Not a day passes in Acapulco without a murder. On this occasion, yellow police tape has cordoned off a side street where a taxi driver was gunned down while waiting for customers. And in the most violent election in Mexico's history, scores of candidates have also been in the firing line. Even the leading candidate for city mayor was murdered as he ate dinner in a restaurant one night.
Okay, amigos, estoy orgulloso aquí en Acapulco, la verdad que llevamos...
Among the first to be killed on the campaign trail was Moisés Juárez Abarca, a nationally renowned gay rights activist and local government candidate for the opposition PRD party. His body was later found dumped in a mass grave.
Alongside my friend, Moises Abarca, I've been in political activism for more than 20 years. This is by far the most violent campaign we've ever seen in the state of Guerrero.
Abarca's childhood friend, Cynthia Juarez, has replaced him on the ticket. She knows full well the risks involved in running for office in his place.
Of course I'm afraid. I'm scared that one day I'll leave my house and never come home. But this is the only way we have to raise our voice and to turn Acapulco back into the thriving port it once was.
Guerrero is now the most dangerous state in Mexico to seek votes. Cynthia took me canvassing with Evodio Velázquez, a former mayor of Acapulco who's endured threats his entire political life. While he was standing for Congress in this election, armed men appeared at his home in an act of intimidation. He's since abandoned the race.
Yo quiero prevenir antes que lamentar.
I'd rather be safe than sorry, he says. I don't want to become just another statistic. I'd called on the authorities for protection, but it fell on deaf ears. They've taken no action at all, he added. The campaign violence has spanned the entire political spectrum. Numerous candidates from the governing party, Morena, have been killed across the country. Voters in Guerrero are likely to re-elect one of the most controversial figures in Mexican politics, Senator Felix Salgado Macedonio. He was forced to drop out of the race for state governor in 2021 over rape and sexual assault allegations. He denied the charges and the case against him was eventually dropped. Throughout the scandal, he counted on the complete support of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Even though official polls show 60% of Mexicans consider their cities unsafe, Senator Salgado Macedonio denies Mr. López Obrador's security strategy has failed.
We have to move forward little by little until we pacify the entire country. But we have another big problem, our neighbor to the north. For drugs to be bought and sold, there must be supply and demand. So, who's consuming the drugs?
As normal life begins to return to Acapulco Beach at the end of this particularly violent campaign, voters will soon choose the men and women to lead Mexico in its seemingly endless drug war. Political violence perpetrated by the drug cartels is nothing new here, but the extent of the problem in this campaign has shocked even seasoned politicians. Names are being removed from the ballot by the bullet, meaning some voters will be forced to choose candidates who best serve the interests of organised crime rather than the needs of their communities.
Well, Grant, in Acapulco, a man who is renovating his wine cellar in Austria has made an extraordinary discovery, not of vintage red or white, but remains of prehistoric creatures. Our correspondent in Vienna, Bethany Bell, takes up the story.
The winemaker, Andreas Pernestorfer, came across a number of huge bones buried deep in his wine cellar in the village of Gobelsburg, west of Vienna. He reported his find to the authorities, who identified them as the bones of at least three Stone Age mammoths. Mr. Pernestorfer said he was renovating his wine cellar when he made the discovery.
I glaube, die haben ein Stück Holz gefunden vom Großvater.
I thought it was just a piece of wood left by my grandfather, but then I dug it out a bit and I remembered that in the past my grandfather said he had found teeth, and then I immediately thought it was a mammoth.
Researchers from the Austrian Archaeological Institute say the bones are estimated to be between 30,000 and 40,000 years old. They've called the find an archaeological sensation. The discovery, they said, raises questions about how Stone Age people hunted mammoths. They believe the mammoths could have died on the spot where the bones were found, chased there by humans who may have set a trap for them. Once they're excavated, the bones will be taken to the Vienna Museum of Natural History.
Now, have you ever had this response when going back to work? That was Wednesday in the UK Parliament, where a politician got a standing ovation going back to work 8 months after contracting sepsis, which led to him having his hands and feet amputated. Sepsis is a rare but serious condition that develops when the body's immune system overreacts to an infection and starts attacking its own tissues and organs. And when Conservative MP Craig McKinley walked into the House of Commons, members on all sides broke the rules and applauded him.
Speaker, this is an emotional day for me, and if you'd indulge me to say a few thanks, because there are a few are due. And one of those, of course, well, an apology, actually, that I've caused the breaking of so many rules today. Clapping. Trainers on because my shoes wouldn't go over the plastic feet, and my jacket wouldn't go over the bionic arm. So apologies for that. But I want to give some thanks. And first of all, the thanks to you, Mr. Speaker, for being there for me, for coming to visit, and I will tell everybody the little story. They thought, the rest of the hospital thought I must be dreadfully ill, because they said, that guy's got the funeral director in already. And to my wife, who's in the chamber, and my daughter and other family members, my father, father-in-law, I'd like to thank my wife for being there every single day of those many months in hospital. And she could only do that because of the support of family behind her.
And to explain the joke, the Speaker of the House of Commons wears black robes in the chamber, a bit like a funeral director. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk is the email address, or on X, we are @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Holly Palmer. The producer was Carl Josephs. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.